The Mongol mercenaries were without fear of death, Michael Rourke realized. They forced their mounts with whips and sabers up into the higher rocks, the animals slipping and skidding under them. Blood on the animals from where they'd been beaten, sometimes visible in a reflected streak of light from an accidentally burnished piece of armor or the flash of a blade. Although the armor seemed more ceremonial, like a costume, than to serve a practical purpose, no single burst from an M16 would put one of them down.
Damn it!
Michael Rourke's rifle was fired out, and there was no time to change magazines. Three of the Mongols, who had whipped and heeled their horses almost vertically along the rock face, neared him. He let the rifle fall to his side on its sling. The Berettas were coming out. One of the men was down, another wounded or simply unhorsed as his animal stumbled. The third man's horse jumped the lip of the rocks directly for Michael. He saw the saber wheeling toward him and deftly sidestepped. His Berettas both holstered, he cross-drew his knife from the sheath at his left hip, throwing his body weight against the legs of the Mongol's mount. The horse, one of the larger animals clearly of Arabian lineage, stumbled under the impact. The man spilled from the saddle, the pistol flying from his hand as his body impacted the ground, the saber still bunched tight in his fist. Michael went for him with the knife old Jan the Icelandic sword maker had crafted for him after the centuries-old pattern of the life support system 2. Steel locked to steel, the saber of the Mongol vastly longer, but the knife in Michael Rourke's right fist feeling more powerful. Michael's body weight hammered the Mongol back even as he rose, forcing him to his knees. Their blades were still crossed. The smell of the Mongol's breath hissed through the yellowed stumps of his teeth, their faces inches apart. The Mongol drew a small, curve-bladed knife. Michael's left hand shot out, grabbing his wrist. The knife was at crotch level as they pushed against one another, each trying to overpower the other's balance, Michael's legs pistoning against the Mongol's superior body weight. Michael drew back, loosing the knife hand. The saber twirled in the Mongol's hand, but Michael knew exactly where it was going. He swatted the saber aside, and Michael threw himself down and forward under the Mongol's charge. Michael had swept the LS2 across the mercenary's thighs and right kneecap, giving him a final lesson about overconfidence. Michael rolled toward the downed Mongol and slammed his knife into the man's back. Michael staggered to his feet, in his mind, for a moment, seeing something from long ago as if it had only just happened. The man in the rumpled clothes who had come into the barn and tried to molest Michael's mother. Michael was seeing his own hand as it clenched over the cat's paw surfaced boning knife they had taken with them from the kitchen of the house they had abandoned following the night of the war. And then Michael was seeing that knife moving in his hand and into the evil man's right kidney, and the man screamed and died, and Sarah, his mother, cried and held him. Michael Rourke was lying there, bullets impacting the rocks around him. His knife was still in his right fist, and he wiped it clean of blood on the dead Mongol's body. He sheathed the knife and took the moment to reload his rifle. More of the Mongols were charging up the steep sides of the gap, regular troops kneeling beside their mounts, firing up into the rocks, the Mongols firing from the saddle as they rode, and with greater accuracy. Two more Mongols went down with Michael's burst, their horses with them. Michael could see the Soviet position on the other side of the gap, his radio headset lost in the fight with the Mongol a moment earlier. There was fighting over there too, hand to hand. He turned around and saw one of the Chinese from the first city, the nearly dying trooper, under attack. Two of the Mongols and a regular Maoist officer were charging down on the man, somehow having circled around them from behind.
No!
The officer and one mercenary went down, but this magazine was spent. Both of the partially spent Beretta pistols came into his hands, but a second too late, the Mongol's saber came down. The first city trooper's head partially separated from his neck, arterial blood spurting into the wind.
Die!
Michael's target spun and fell to the ground. Michael turned to the sound. The Soviet medical corpsman was using his empty rifle like a club, trying to fend off two Mongols with sabers. Both pistols were empty now. As the Soviet medic tried for a momentary advantage with the Mongol saber found its target. Michael Rourke's right hand found the butt of the .44 Magnum revolver. The corpsman was beyond any help. The saber was stuck deep in his chest, having traveled a good foot from where it had entered his neck. Michael turned toward the rocks across which more of the Mongols were coming. A Mongol horseman charged, his saber flying. Michael wheeled toward the second horse to fire, the saber coming as he backstepped. An instant before it happened, Michael Rourke realized he was too late. The young pilot named Lintz sat at the controls of the J-7V.
Did you get to radio your wife, Olga?
Yes, Herr Doctor. And she misses me so. Thank you.
I bet she does. Sometimes... Annie!
Rourke punched the safety restraints quick release and was up, moving along the fuselage.
Paul, what happened?
I don't know. We were just sitting here and she just started.
It's Michael! Paul! Daddy, it's Michael! I saw it! Oh! Oh!
Annie!
Daddy!
Tell me what you saw.
It was something like a sword. And it caught in the light and there was an explosion, but it was inside Michael's head and I felt it. Oh, Daddy!
Shh! All right, baby.
Oh!
Rourke held her in his arms. His eyes met Paul's, and he moved his daughter out of his own arms and into Paul's, then rested back on his haunches. His daughter had not been born with a gift. It was a curse in the truest sense of the word. John Rourke closed his eyes. They had stopped for refueling at the base outside the Hecla community, and as a courtesy, although he could barely concentrate on the few words he spoke to her, Rourke called the president of Lidveldid Island, Madame Jokli. When she had asked if all were well, he had told her simply that he would see. And then the aircraft was off again, speeding across the now deserted British Isles, making radio contact with the smallish base in France, where there was a small German installation to assist the relocated people of the Wild Tribes, cutting across Italy and the Adriatic, and across Greece, and landing in Turkey near the Bosporus, where a small German garrison held a synth fuel station, and then airborne again toward China. Once Annie had calmed down sufficiently, Rourke had administered a sedative by injection, letting her fall asleep in Paul's arms, then helping Paul to cover her with a blanket. As the sedative wore off, her breathing became even and regular, her sleep natural. That she seemed totally dreamless chilled John Rourke more than if she had been actively dreaming, restless. Was she no longer experiencing Michael's assumed plight because Michael was safe, or because he was dead? Like any parent, he had always wanted for his children to live in happiness and peace. Michael, if he still lived, had been widowed, his wife of so little time, Madison, and the unborn child she carried, murdered in one of the Soviet terror raids on Hecla. And Annie, the ability to see what logic dictated could not be seen, to invade the thoughts of others. Her abilities, extrasensory, psychic, paranormal, whatever the term, seemed only to be increasing. And he had noticed the faintest beginnings of such abilities in his son, although he doubted they would ever even approach the magnitude of hers. Was it the effect of the sleep on their young minds, or was it simply something that would have surfaced regardless of circumstance? Rourke doubted the latter. After first becoming aware of Annie's abilities, Dr. Munchen had asked for the opportunity of testing them, first calling for Rourke and Paul Rubinstein, asking permission of father and husband before asking hers. They had both simply deferred to Annie's own choice. She had gone ahead with the tests. Using standard tests, largely unchanged from the days in medical school when some of Rourke's fellow students had played with cards, tested each other's responses, Annie had passed faultlessly. There was not a star, nor a triangle, nor a wavy line she could not read through the back of the card. There was not a sealed envelope whose contents she could not discern, although they were known only to Munchen. But she almost never tried, because, as she had made abundantly clear, she was frightened of this ability. It was the dreams which most terrified John Rourke. She would see danger, feel it, almost experience it. It was such a dream which had caused her to hasten the time of the awakening when she had known Michael was in danger for his life.
Oh, Michael!
Michael Rourke's eyes felt as if they were on fire and simultaneously coated with salt, his entire body consumed with more pain than he had ever known, as if the pain from the sword blow had never ended, was eternal. His vision was blurred, and his muscles were cramped, and through the blur, when he again forced his eyes open, he could see Prokopyev, the right side of Prokopyev's face covered in blood. Michael started to turn his head. As he raised his head, the pain returned, and when his eyes opened, he could not fully part the lids. He moved his hands, and the muscles in his neck and shoulders cried out to him, and he stopped moving, fighting to remain conscious this time. Slowly, moving as little as possible, his hands reached his face, and his eyes were all but crusted over. As gently as he could, his fingers, swollen and stiff, he pulled at the scabs of blood until his right eye opened. His vision cleared after a few seconds. He began to work at the left eye, the result the same, but there was terrible pain in his left temple. With his restored vision, although he could not yet move his head, he watched Vasily Prokopyev, the Russian commander, appearing more dead than alive and unmoved since Michael had last looked at him. How long ago? He felt for his wristwatch. The Rolex was gone. The Mongols. He shivered, and when the cold washed over him, the pain increased, and he looked at his feet. Shackles were about his bare ankles, his boots and socks gone.
Prokopyev?
The Russian commander was alive, at least.
Prokopyev. Vasily Prokopyev.
Prokopyev's head moved slightly, then sagged down to his chest. Michael fought to keep focus. Prokopyev, as well, was bootless, ankles shackled. But they had left him his socks. Prokopyev's BDU jacket was gone, the pistol belt gone, too. His black sweater half-ripped from his upper body and bloodstains visible along his neck. Slowly, so he would not pass out again, Michael Rourke began to move his head to the right. Another Russian, the face blue-veined and livid, the ankles shackled, dead on the almost black stone floor less than 2 yards away. Still another Russian, a crude bandage over his naked chest, the bandage saturated dark red with blood, ankles shackled. Michael arced his head left, slowly, seeing the dead man again, seeing Prokopyev again, his head and eyes stopping as he reached the heavy steel door a yard from him. He was tempted to shout if his voice still worked well enough for that, but he did not shout, instead returning his gaze to Prokopyev. Michael closed his eyes again and began to focus on what had to be done. The still-living, seriously wounded Russian. Check the chest wound, see if the bleeding has stopped. He reminded himself that was contingent on whether or not he could walk or crawl, or for that matter, whether or not the shackles on his ankles were somehow fastened to the wall against which he leaned. He tried raising his left hand to inspect the wound to his head from the sword blow. Michael opened his eyes, this time without great difficulty. They were not crusted over, and he presumed the bleeding had stopped. He was colder than he had been, but he was aware of a throbbing pain on the left side of his head near the crown of the skull, which, he theorized, meant that his overall pain level had reduced. Slowly, he moved his head, raising it, leaning his back against the damp stone of the wall against which he reclined. The chamber's ceiling seemed at least a dozen feet above him, but that could have been perspective. He would know better when he stood. But first, the shackles. He lowered his head, pain washing over him, but consciousness not ebbing. He visually inspected the shackles. They were steel, the chain links seeming sturdy, but the shackles were not attached to any chain leading to the wall. The distance between the shackles was perhaps 18 inches, which would make walking difficult if he could stand. And his balance would be impeded by them, of course, Michael reminded himself. He tried to stand, his back twisting with the agony of movement. He fell partially forward, but kept conscious, catching himself on his hands. There was no time for the luxury of unconsciousness. He would save standing until later. On hands and knees, he crawled across the damp floor to Prokopyev, checking vital signs as best he could. If there were ever an end to this, he had decided that he would go to New Germany, or perhaps to the American colony Midwake, and study medicine. Prokopyev, despite the visually poor condition, had a strong pulse. Quickly, Michael inspected the wounds that he could readily discern. What looked like a bullet crease across the left temple. It had bled considerably because there seemed to be no other wounds to the head or face. A shoulder wound, but the collarbone did not appear broken, and the bleeding had stopped all but for a trickle as Michael examined it. The right shoulder appeared to be dislocated. While he was unconscious was the best time to try it. Michael gently laid Prokopyev flat on the floor, taking the right arm by the wrist and gradually inscribing an ever-enlarging arc. Michael felt the shoulder. The dislocation was reduced. There was likely substantial muscle damage, but in time that would heal. But he needed something with which to bind the arm so it would not dislocate at the ball and socket of the shoulder joint again. He considered using a portion of Prokopyev's already tattered sweater, but thought better of it. Instead, he crawled on hands and knees to the already stiffened body of the dead Russian elite corpsman. He stripped off the dead man's pants, the legs of the BDU trousers long enough that he could bind both the dislocation and apply a portion of the trousers as packing to the left shoulder, where there was a bullet wound. He set to work on packing, but it wasn't long before he was interrupted.
What the hell?
Michael crawled toward the door, reaching up to the bars set at chest height, touching at them gingerly lest they were electrified, then pulling himself to a standing position, the change in circulatory pattern instantly bringing him nausea and dizziness. He swayed, leaned heavily against the door, and controlled his breathing. He peered through the bars. Mongols, Second City Chinese regulars, and a beefy-looking man, naked except for long underpants, his wrists and ankles shackled to some sort of table with crank handles attached to both top and bottom. One of the Mongols brandished a sword in the man's face. And then someone entered the chamber and stood beside the table on which the Russian was secured. A woman, tall, graceful, hair as black as the night well past her waist, her slender body covered in robes of maroon cloth like velvet and decorated with gold-stitched figures of dragons and griffins. She reached to one of the crank handles on the table. Michael closed his eyes, leaning his head heavily against the bars. Ego, humanity, all demanded that he shout, ordering him to stop torturing the man. It was a medieval rack of some sort. But logic dictated attending to the injured man with the chest wound, then trying to rouse Prokopyev. He turned away from the bars and set about doing what had to be done, securing Prokopyev's bandaging first. The screams haunted him, and so did the woman who was causing them. He set to work on the man with the chest wound, on his knees again, his balance better that way, working gently in the gray light to pry away just enough of the packing that if the soldier's bleeding had stopped, he would not inadvertently restart it. But the bleeding hadn't stopped. The pulse was weak, the respiration labored, the skin colder even than it should have been considering the ambient temperature of the room, or dungeon, in which they were confined. The lungs were likely filling with blood, one of them perhaps already collapsed. Michael looked back. The woman in the velvet robes was standing in the door, her face exquisite except for her eyes. The lids looked like deep, blue-tinted shrouds.
This man is dying. He needs a doctor.
He needs a debt.
No.
One of the Mongols walked past her, drawing his saber. Michael wasted no time. As both of Michael's hands locked around his opponent's wrists, he smashed his left knee into the man's groin. As the Mongol sagged, Michael lost his balance, unable to recover it, falling in a heap to the floor with the Mongol beside him. But Michael took the saber from the ground. Michael looked up to see two more guards rushing into the room to replace the one he had just dispatched. One ran for him, the other to the dying Russian soldier.
No!
The man's fist had sent Michael sprawling, his head spinning. He looked up just in time to see the butt of a gun coming down. John Rourke had planned ahead. After their initial success, he had ordered the construction of several more motorcycles beyond the original four, the Germans gladly complying. The original colors had been white for the prototype left for the German engineers to play with, a dark, almost British racing green for Natalia, a medium blue one for Paul Rubinstein, and Rourke's own, colored like his Harley, jet black. All four of these, plus one more, were waiting as the J-7V touched down, and Rourke looked to the far edge of the landing field. The German specials. But why were there five of them rather than three? About the size of his jet-black Harley lowrider, they combined the best features of 20th century motorcycles and the modern materials and design genius of the same corps of German engineers which had designed the versatile and reliable all-terrain mini-tanks. Their value had been proven against the murderous combination of elements, which had all but conspired to thwart their efforts to stop the Soviet commandeered train and its cargo of Chinese missiles, eventually resulting in the derailment of the train, the loss of the stolen pre-war Chinese missiles, and the death of Ivan Krakovsky, then Karamazov's effective second-in-command. Capable of cranking up to 160 miles per hour on level dry terrain, they were, like the mini-tanks, capable as well of maneuvering over the most rugged terrain, taking whatever nature might offer as a challenge. Deep snow, loose mud, sand. He had requested that they be readied, and they were. Built to run on synth fuel, and more fuel-efficient than any motorcycle had ever been in the past, regardless of power rating, the Special would virtually go anywhere. And to get the rider there and back again, each Special featured a precisely contoured armored fairing to protect the lower body, a high-rising windshield over this, fitted with defogger coils. Built into the fairing on either side were 12-inch barreled machine guns, like submachine guns in their diminutive size, firing the German major-caliber ceaseless service round. Firing mechanisms were concealed within the handlebars. There was capacity for gear storage behind and on both sides of the saddle, and to a lesser extent, built into the fairing. Emplaced just aft of the rear storage compartments were weapons pods, launching high-explosive mini-grenades from the left pod, smoke or gas grenades from the right pod. The fifth special was gunmetal gray. Despite his and Paul's vehement protests, Annie had insisted that she be allowed to accompany them, that she could ride a motorcycle as well as any of them. Rourke, Annie, and Paul exited the VTOL. The machines had been joined by four figures, three of them unmistakably women, the fourth in traditional Chinese male attire with a heavy parka over it. John Rourke started walking across the runway. Chinese soldiers of the first city already began to unload the gear as he glanced back, noticing them for the first time, his attention focused elsewhere. One of the women was his wife, Sarah, and standing beside her, Natalia, and beside Natalia, Maria Leuden. The man was the chairman of the first Chinese city. Rourke reached the four who stood beside the five specials and took Sarah into his arms.
What's happened to Michael?
Annie felt him getting injured. That's all I know, but it's enough. Natalia, you should be resting.
My doctor says that healthy diversion is just the thing. Bjorn Rolvag sends his compliments, by the way. He's recovering splendidly and more rapidly than anyone would have thought possible. I tried arguing them into bringing his dog up to see him, but no luck. Perhaps you could ask the chairman.
Well, chairman, I am honored that you would come to meet us here. Who are the other two cycles for?
I know I can't go. I was never that much for motorcycles anyway.
I'm going, and Maria, it turns out, rode motorcycles in New Germany.
Uh-uh. The last place I want either of you is...
I'm going, John, with you or without you. And Maria... Well, she can decide.
If Michael's in danger, then I'm going so I can help get him out of it.
Good for you, Maria.
John Rourke looked at Annie Rourke Rubenstein.
We're going we don't quite know where against we don't quite know whom. It's not the ideal circumstances for a learning experience, hmm?
I'm going, and that's final.
You can do a lot of things, John Rourke, but nobody can change a woman's mind when she's made it up.
John Rourke stood beside the jet-black special, buckling on his gear. With the death of his Python, until he could get it restored, there had been only one logical choice in substitute armament. The hydrostatic shock value of the 357 Magnum fired from a 6-inch barrel was something he relied on, despite his preference for his little Detonix 45s and his strong liking for the twin Scoremasters. But his only other Python was factory standard, and he liked a revolver to be action-tuned for buttery, smooth, even double action, and he liked a big-bore revolver magna-ported. He could work the spare Python's action with time to the sort of trigger that he liked, but time was a luxury he could not afford now. He elected instead to utilize one of the 44 Magnum revolvers, greater hydrostatic shock value, and if one knew how, nearly as controllable. John Rourke knew how. The gun was a 6-inch Smith & Wesson Model 629, not unlike the 4-incher Michael carried. But like his Python, it was action-tuned before the night of the war by Metalife Industries, and then the barrel slotted via MagnaPort process for reduced perception of felt recoil and reduced muzzle climb. Fitted with the large-size Packmeyer rubber grips, it felt essentially the same as the Python in the hand. Among the ammunition he had gotten the Germans to custom fabricate for him had been a considerable amount of the 180-grain jacketed hollow point duplicated after the Federal cartridge loading from 5 centuries before. His original intent had been that it would be for Michael's use, but now that had changed. He had taken Safariland speed loaders from the accessories cache, the ones Michael hadn't taken already, using 4 principally, carrying the rest of his spare ammo for the weapon boxed in MTM-50 cases. The belt he'd selected was a single-billeted one with a wide, double-sided solid brass buckle, the holster one he had painstakingly preserved from the days before the night of the war, handmade, one-of-a-kind, by Milt Sparks leather. It was made entirely to his specifications to afford maximum protection in the field, the black full-flap leather envelope riding the gun low in the leather, the flap completely protecting it like no commercially available holster could have done. He buckled the belt at his waist over the Arctic parka now. The grain LS-10 transferred from his trouser belt to the gun belt for easier accessibility. John Rourke straddled the machine. Sarah was standing beside him.
I'll bring him back, Sarah.
I know you will. I love you very much.
She threw her arms around his neck and Rourke held her tightly. her abdomen with the life it carried pressed close against him.
I know you will, but you come back too, John.
You got a deal. And I love you.
He looked to Paul and Annie, Annie's holsters buckled over her coat, Paul with a Schmeisser and an M16 slung crossbody on either side. Natalia, her double L-frame Smith rig buckled over her coat, Maria Lloyden with a Beretta 92F and an M16. This was quite the rescue party. He pulled on his helmet, the helmet systems powered by electrochemical energy from the body. He looked at the three women, Annie and Maria for a moment seeming ridiculous with their hair well below the levels of the helmets they wore, Natalia's hair shorter and stuffed up inside, he supposed. He tested the helmet's microphone.
Everyone on?
Sure. Yeah. Affirmative.
He pulled down the visor and the tinted overvisor, his tinted darker than the rest, the automatic defogging systems taking over instantly, clearing them. Sarah stepped back as the engine roared to life. Rourke started moving the jet black special ahead, the kickstand automatically releasing. The ground was dry and flat. He was uneasy over having Natalia so fresh from the hospital accompanying them, uneasy over Maria Lloyden's inexperience, uneasy over Annie's safety, and Sarah being left totally alone here, except for the injured Bjorn Rolvag, and uneasy over Michael.
Let's get these things out to 60 nice and slowly. Natalia, keep an eye on Maria. Maria, sing out if you have any trouble. Annie at all. Annie, you doing all right?
Fine, Daddy.
Now take it easy. These are lots faster than the Harleys, okay?
Okay. Thank you for letting me come along.
For letting you come?
Rourke guided the machine off the surface of the field and glanced at the instrument package compass as he turned the fork to veer slightly right.
You're welcome. Just do as you're told, kid.
He started building speed, the others on the other side of him.
Paul, running okay?
I still like a Harley better.
They'll do 160. We won't, but we need to get them a little over 100 and familiarize ourselves with the handling. Check your instrument package digital chronometers. Every 60 seconds, increase speed by 5 miles per hour until you reach 105, or unless you're experiencing difficulties. Acknowledge.
Yes, acknowledged. Sure.
Begin now.
65, 70, 75, 80, 85.
You doing all right, Maria?
Yes, Dr. Rourke. I'm doing fine, as you say.
Good. Annie?
This is neat.
Concentrate on your driving.
90, 95, 100, 105. He held there, the ground starting to rise slowly now.
Any problems? Excess vibration? Good. Let's try the same method, taking it up to 125, no further. The only three of us experienced enough, even with these machines, to take a bike up higher are Natalia, Paul, and myself. And no Mongo Przewalski horses are going to get anywhere near us. Go for 110.
110, 115, 120, 125.
All right, still no problems? Come on, talk to me, Annie.
No problems, Daddy.
Good. Anybody else?
The ground was leveling off here, and they were already well away from the airfield.
On my signal, begin a slow turn left, bringing speed down to 90. Then on my command, open fire with your fairing guns. Just a short burst from each to get the feel of them. Now be ready. Start to decelerate. Start the turn.
Rourke started banking the special left, the brakes responding smoothly, evenly, the suspension so perfectly balanced that he could barely feel the motion.
Activate the safety now!
The rocks at the far end of the plateau shattered under the impact of the German ceaseless rounds.
Cease fire!
John, no problems at all!
Good. Keep an eye on Maria.
She's doing fine, John.
You feeling okay now, you sure?
Yes, I'm feeling wonderful. It's good to be doing something again.
Good to hear. All right, everybody. We're going to cut back right and keep a single file as we head toward the second city. We're taking the route Michael, Han, Otto, and the enlisted personnel took, and we should cover their route in just a matter of hours, because we'll be traveling so much faster than they were. Be your own best judge on speed, but especially you, Maria. Don't push beyond your capabilities. We can cut speed without delaying ourselves very much.
I understand, Dr. Rourke. Thank you. What speed should I try?
Let's keep it at 105, as long as it stays flat and even.
They were into formation now, Rourke at the lead, peeling off, dropping his speed so the others would pass him, and he could have a personal look at how Maria Lloyden was handling her machine. As she passed him, he nodded to himself with approval, then increased speed to 110 so he could overtake them all and resume the lead, swinging in, cutting back on speed again. He looked at the instrument package digital. In a few hours, they would know. If it had just been Paul, Natalia, and himself, he would have risked closer to 130, at least here. He shook his head. They had everything they needed, except patience. His fists balled on the handlebars of the jet-black special he rode. When he awoke, Michael realized his ankles were no longer shackled. When he tried to move, he realized his head had been bandaged and that he was reclining on a very soft bed or large couch.
You saved my life, Rourke.
Hmm?
It was Prokopyev's voice from behind him, and Michael Rourke sat up. The pain, a dull roar behind his eyes, but manageable for now. He looked for Prokopyev. The Russian officer, in his BDU pants but with a white shirt draped over his shoulders, his right arm in a professional-looking sling, his left arm outstretched beside him, sat on a stack of silk pillows by the far wall. Michael swung his feet over the side. His boots and socks were by the edge of the bed.
But more importantly, thank you for attempting to save the life of Corporal Kamarovsky.
The man with the chest wound. They
slaughtered him, yes. Gutted him like a pig.
What about the man they had on the rack?
That was Senior Sergeant Yaroslav, an old friend as well as a valiant soldier and loyal communist. His spine had snapped, and they slit his throat as they carried us from the cell. I feigned unconsciousness because then I was unable to move. They treated my shoulder wound, cleaned it, and bandaged it. I can use my left arm a little. She ordered them to take care of us. Your head wound was cleaned and properly bandaged. You're fortunate to still be alive.
Maybe. Who the hell is she?
Michael brought his feet to the level of the bed rather than attempting to lean over to get his combat boots on.
I do not know. But she told me that I should relay this message. We will be publicly executed at dawn. I elected not to sleep. Rather enjoy my last hours of life while I'm awake.
Michael noticed that his watch had been returned, none the worse for wear.
Dawn, hmm? Well, lucky for us it's winter time. Maybe it'll be overcast. I'm sorry about your friend, the sergeant. There wasn't anything I...
You have placed me in a peculiar position. I'm almost pleased we are dying. Otherwise, I would be faced with a severe conflict between duty and conscience. You are a brave man, and I am forever in your debt.
Forever doesn't promise to be too long. Any idea where our guns are?
No.
Any idea why she cleaned us up instead of torturing us?
No, perhaps she'll tell us. But you know how they do it. I refer, of course, to the method by which they execute.
Michael thought for a moment.
The classic Chinese methods of execution range from the headsman's axe to being thrown into a pit to be ripped apart by dogs. But I take it she told you?
At dawn, as you know, before the assembled population of the second city. Perhaps that is why we were cleaned up, for a better show. Their method is barbaric but effective. We will be placed on the ground, hands and ankles tied to ropes, each of the ropes tied to the saddle of one of the Mongols. Then the Mongols ordered to ride.
It's a form of drawing and quartering. The Egyptians practiced it millennia ago.
You are more knowledgeable of history than I.
It goes with being 5 centuries old. I had a lot of time to read. At dawn. Well, we've got maybe 4 hours to get ourselves out of here.
Perhaps your two friends will bring the army led by your father and rescue you?
Perhaps your two men will bring the army led by Colonel Antonovich and do the same for you, Vasily.
There's a word in one of the old languages.
French. The word is touché. No army?
Reconnaissance only for an impending military action, suffice it to say. And you?
No army. You were going to be extracted? A couple of gunships?
Yes, but they could have scared off General Wing's army satisfactorily.
That the old guy's name? Wing?
Yes, she told me that. Also that General Wing would be there to watch us executed for our merciless ambush of his column.
Michael had both boots laced, and slowly he tried to stand up. It didn't work instantly.
Any electronic surveillance in the room? What's the status on guards?
Nothing electronic that I can detect. And there are 2 guards at the doorway just outside. The windows are barred and overlook a precipice of considerable height. Even if we were able to get through the bars somehow, we would never be able to climb down without the most sophisticated climbing equipment, and certainly not I.
Rappel?
Beneath us is the interior of the second city. If we were not shot and did make it down, we would be recaptured or shot as soon as we did.
Then it's the door.
I won't be much good to you in a fight, Michael.
That's okay. You'll agree, since we're going to be executed and they've chosen a particularly nasty way to die, we have nothing to lose. Right?
Agreed.
Right. Just give me a couple of minutes to get my head going.
He slowly turned his head toward the doorway. It was an ordinary doorway, if slightly large and rather ornate. His father had always taught him that there was nothing to lose in the face of certain death by being as daring as circumstances would allow. He intended to test the theory. He stood up, feeling slightly dizzy, his eyes scanning over the room for something that might be used as a weapon. There were pillows, there was a second bed, there was a long, slender tapestry that he imagined was some sort of bell rope to summon the last hearty meal for the condemned.
Does she execute people often? I mean, is this death row we're in, you think?
Death row?
A place to wait until it is time for a death sentence to be carried out.
I do not know.
Don't have a knife or anything they didn't find, do you?
None whatsoever.
Did she say we could call for a meal?
Yes, I'm not hungry. The medication, I think.
I'm hungry. Probably throw it up, but I am hungry. It'd be too much to hope for that we could throttle a guard when the food was brought in. But maybe something with the food. I don't know. Anyway, if we're to be the entertainment at dawn, may as well make them work for it a little.
He decided as he walked slowly, slightly unsteadily across the room to pull the bell rope, that the next time he was under sentence of death, it would be decidedly better to have it occur in a country which traditionally used steak knives rather than chopsticks. Akira Kurinami had stood as Commander Christopher Dodd entered the room, Dodd's eyes meeting his. Wolfgang Mann simply rolled his eyes.
Sit down, Commander.
Dodd ignored the request and never once shifted his eyes from Kurinami's.
Colonel Mann, how dare you hold this man and his female accomplice in total defiance of my request?
His vituperation apparently spent, at least for the moment, Commander Dodd finally took a seat.
I demand an explanation, Colonel.
Lieutenant Kurinami, would you care to provide an explanation?
Yes, sir. Dr. Halvorsen and I are the objects of a murder plot because I wisely duplicated the now blanked files in the Eden Project main computer. Without those duplicate records, only the persons responsible for blanking the files would know the locations of the strategic supply caches located throughout the United States, strategic fuel reserves, and the like. I discovered the theft of a quantity of M16 rifles, ammunition, food stores, and medical supplies, and other equipment. Because of all of this, I was kidnapped, forcibly detained, and the attempt was made to have me divulge the location of the duplicate computer records. When this failed, Dr. Elaine Harrison, my fiancée, was kidnapped, apparently to force my cooperation. I was able to free her, bring her here for refuge. Then, before all the facts were known, I was to be turned over to Commander Dodd, along with Dr. Harrison. We fled, fearing for our lives, reached the retreat of Dr. John Rock. There, 8 men, German nationals.
This is no—
Preposterous. Let me finish, Commander. I implore you.
Dodd shook his head but remained silent.
8 men. German nationals, fugitives from the legitimate government of New Germany, followed us, attempted to use explosives to gain entrance to the retreat, and were only foiled by the singular heroism of Dr. John Rourke, Dr. Rourke's daughter Annie, and her husband Paul Rubinstein, who caused the deaths of those 8 men. They were utilizing M16 rifles, most probably from among those missing from Eden Base inventory, German pistols, and stolen German rocket launchers. These fugitive men included at least one man, Hans Weil, who is a known Nazi sympathizer and working for the violent overthrow of the government of New Germany. At Dr. Rourke's request, Dr. Halvorsen and myself have been offered temporary political asylum by Colonel Mann, acting on behalf of Dieter Bern, president of New Germany.
Is this true?
You know, I was about to ask you much the same question, Herr Commander Dodd.
I meant the political asylum.
Our base, because we are allies, is considered by ourselves, at least, as a diplomatic legation. Hence, a piece of New Germany here in your own land. We feel well within our legal rights to offer endangered persons political asylum, Commander. Oh, forgive my rudeness, but I am quite tired. Would you care for a cigarette?
What law do you refer to, Colonel? There is no international law. Kuranami is subject to the military discipline of Eden Base Command. He is mine, and so is his accomplice, Dr. Halverson.
Your use of the word accomplice fascinates me, Herr Commander Dodd. It would appear that none of the Eden personnel are unaccounted for, yet you insist that the lieutenant has murdered someone. Who might these dead be? German nationals who are enemies of the state? Wanted criminals whom you have chosen to give political asylum? Criminals with whom you, perhaps, sympathize?
I don't have to take your insults, Colonel.
Indeed, you do not. Nor do I have to return Lieutenant Kuranami and his fiancée, the Fräulein Doctor. Would you care for coffee? I can have it sent around.
This tears it, Colonel. I want your base out of here. Off American territory immediately.
Kuranami watched Colonel Mann's eyes. They remained impassive, the smile on his face unchanged.
I will speak candidly also, if I may, Commander. If, for one moment, I thought you represented the just wishes of the Eden Base personnel, I would never have encouraged my government to set up this support facility in the first place. My opinion has not changed. If the people of Eden Base are polled fairly, and my government is requested to evacuate this base, I can say without reservation that it will be done. If Dr. Rourke were to tell us that we should leave, we most assuredly would. I have little interest in your opinion, and less interest in your concerns. But I am very much interested in your affiliations with men such as the late Hans Weil. And it is only out of respect for the survivors at Eden Base, and out of the greatest respect for Dr. Rourke, that I do not now have you arrested. Are you certain about the coffee, Commander?
You refuse to honor my request for the return of my prisoners. You refuse to honor my ultimatum for the removal of your base. You have not heard the last of me.
If I had heard the last of you, Commander Dodd, I would truly rejoice. I take it you have pressing business elsewhere.
You rotten little son of a bitch. You can hide here, but you have to come out sometime, and then your ass is mine.
I would gladly, Commander Dodd, accept your personal challenge at any time.
Get fucked.
That man is more than insane. He is dangerous.
It seemed to Akira Kuranami that he was stating the obvious. They rode on through the night, the vision intensification equipment within their helmets making the ground before them as bright as a cloudy day, but running lights of any kind unnecessary. As they approached a progressively narrowing gap, still several hundred yards away, they had reduced speed to 50 miles per hour as they had begun to climb, John Rourke spoke into the headset within his helmet chin guard.
Where the rocks narrow up ahead, it's a good spot for an ambush. Paul, you stay with Annie and Marie to back us up. Natalia, come up to the entrance to the gap with me, then wait till I'm through. Cover me. Once I'm through, I'll radio back and cover you, then Paul, you bring Annie and Maria through. Any questions?
I can go through.
I know you can, but it's my turn.
Rourke said nothing more, gradually accelerating to a little over 60 as Natalia pulled up alongside him, the others falling off as he looked back once. He and Natalia slowed as the grade steepened, stopping their specials at the entrance to the gap.
How you feeling? Tired?
They both knew that any and all could hear whatever words were exchanged between them over the commonly shared bands.
A little, but I like these machines. It would be wonderful sometime just to get on one and ride and never stop until you reached a place where it was always green and people didn't want to kill one another. Wouldn't it, John?
Maybe we'll all find such a place someday. At least we can keep looking. You'll be all right out here?
Anything goes bad, I'll be right there with you.
He turned his head to look at her, but the helmet and visor were anonymous looking, and he could see nothing of her face, nothing of her eyes or her hair.
I've always known that.
He gunned the special into the gap, reaching the high ground where it leveled and slowing to under 20, his eyes scanning the ground. If tragedy had befallen Michael, this was as likely a place as any, and more likely than most.
If any of you heard the skid, I'm fine.
He dismounted as he kicked out the stand, keeping his helmet visors in place so he could see with the aid of vision intensification rather than the naked eye. There was brass on the ground, 5.56mm, as was fired in the M16s like Michael carried, along with the type used with AK weapons. Michael had indicated after his accidental encounter with the Mongols that they were armed with weapons of this type, but apparently of fresh manufacture. These and originals and copies of the Glock 17 9mm pistols. There were 9mm casings on the ground as well, but without detailed analysis, he was unable to tell if they were from one of the Glock types or from the Berettas carried by Michael. He was increasingly aware of his Metalife Magna-ported 6-inch 6.29 waiting in its holster.
I'm on foot. There are signs of a significant number of metallic cartridges having been fired here recently. The brass is untarnished. I'm going up the gap toward where it begins to narrow. First sign of a shot, it'll be a loud one from my revolver. But at the first sign, Paul, you get Annie and Marie up to high ground where they can cover. Natalia, you wait for Paul. Come in after me if I call.
There was a large dark shape looming ahead on the ground. As he neared it, its shape was better defined. It was a dead horse, the carcass untouched. But the horse was too big for the horses that Michael and the rest of his party had utilized. It looked almost part Arabian. There was another dead horse about 100 yards further along. He looked toward the east and west elevations of the gap. Ambushers would logically have fired down from both sides. But what would provide cover from which to return fire if the first rounds hadn't ended it, which apparently was the case? His eyes moved from side to side along the floor of the gap, and at last he spotted a likely location, a sharply jutting overhang, which would have protected anyone beneath it from enemy fire from above, and afforded cover from behind which fire could be returned to the far sides of the gap. Rourke picked up the pace, his gloved right fist balling on the 6.29. He stopped just before the rocks, 223 brass in abundance here, in greater abundance on the other side as he crossed over the rocks and down. He holstered his revolver and drew the grain knife from its sheath at his left side. He scraped the knife against a rock surface. Dried blood fell off like paint chips.
Natalia, see if you can get your machine up to the eastern side of the gap. Paul, you and Annie and Maria move up a little. I'm going up to the west side. And everybody, be careful.
He began to climb, carefully checking his footing as he moved, finding a solid purchase, climbing on, at last reaching the western summit. Here he found several bodies, Chinese, and judging from the socks on one of the otherwise denuded bodies, German. And curiously, a body that could have been Russian, again the only thing to tell by being the socks. Boots, trousers, winter clothes, even underwear were gone, not to mention weapons. He found considerable quantities of 9mm and 223 brass here.
Natalia, you in position yet?
Yes. There is no rifle brass nor handgun brass. There are plenty of Russian bodies, I can tell from the stockings. Otherwise, all the clothing and weapons are gone. Some of these men had their throats slit, others...
Now, one man here is partially beheaded. A couple of dead horses down at the base of the rocks that I can see from here. Get back down. I'd like to say we could bury him, but there isn't time.
Daddy?
What, Annie?
Michael was here. In that dream I had, I saw a place like this. He was here. I think this is where...
Yeah, where it happened.
But what? The only chance was to go to the second Chinese city, and he hadn't brought an army. There hadn't been time for that either.
Paul, get on that other radio and get to Hartman's man at the second city. See if he can shake us loose a couple of gunships to get within 15 minutes striking range of the second city and wait there for us to call them in.
Right, John.
It looks like there was a battle here of considerable proportions. A lot of bodies, all Chinese, our Chinese, I'd say, and Russian. No sign of Michael, Han, or Otto. The AK brass I found makes it look like the Mongols were in on it, so I don't have any idea what went on here. But I got a bad feeling we don't have too much time to find out.
Daddy?
What, Annie?
Michael's alive. I can feel it somehow. I think he's trying to reach me. I know that sounds crazy.
We wouldn't have been here at all to find this if it hadn't been for your dream. Just keep me informed on what you feel, what you think is happening, baby.
All right, Daddy.
Rourke looked at the luminous black face of the Rolex on his left wrist. In a little while, it would be light, perhaps making the task of finding out what was happening a little easier. But somehow, the thought of the sun rising made him shiver. Han Lu Chen moved through the sparse crowds of those who were up before the rest of the second city. They were old Mongols, too old to fight as mercenaries, not old enough to make a living as beggars, carrying harp-shaped frames made of plastic or old pieces of metal tubing, with trinkets and baubles and even food hanging from them, peddling their wares to others like them, the real customers not yet in the streets, likely not yet awake. He shifted the weight of the pistol belt which carried his Glock and his saber, hooking his thumbs in the belt as he stopped to admire a piece of cheap jewelry. The word was everywhere on the streets that at dawn there would be the execution of two foreign devils, one of the victims a Russian, the other an American. Most of the conversation that he overheard, which did not gleefully focus on the means of execution, focused instead on what an American might be. This was the first time he had ever penetrated into the second city beyond the outer perimeter that lay just inside the gates. Han cared little what befell the Russian, but the American had to be Michael Rourke. In casual conversation around Mongol campfires, the Mongols had joked concerning the religion here in the second city, saying that they worshipped a silly post. But as he entered the common square, Han Lu Chen stopped, stared, powerless to do otherwise. He had never seen one fully assembled, standing, only the crated parts that time aboard the train. But he had seen pictures of such things. These people did not worship a post, as the Mongols had joked. What he saw upthrusting from the center of their temple was a ballistic missile.
You! Do you care for the pleasures of the flesh? I have a beautiful girl here willing to perform wondrous acts for merely a pittance.
I do not want her.
A boy, then. I have two boys.
No.
He shrugged past the old Mongol. The second city had its missiles, and they were about to execute Michael Rourke. He would have glanced at his watch, but to do so would have aroused suspicion, since few Mongols told time by any means other than a sundial or an hourglass. It was only within the last dozen years that the Mongols had been elevated to their present exalted status of mercenary soldiers. Before that, a violent subculture treated as racial inferiors and afforded not even the most rudimentary learning. And it couldn't be long now until dawn would come. Otto Hammerschmidt had nearly given up hope, but he saw the Chinese intelligence agent coming now, climbing up into the rocks, looking warily over his shoulder every few steps. Hammerschmidt wanted to shout to him, but a shout, or any loud noise, was well within earshot of any guards at the outer gates into the mountain, and to betray his position would mean his own death and Han's as well. Any chance to locate Michael Rourke would die with them. Where were the Russians? Even they were better than these savages. Or perhaps the Soviet commander's men had not gotten through, perhaps been intercepted by more of the Second City military forces. There were too many things unresolved. Was Michael inside the Second City, dead or soon to be? Or was he somewhere in this vast rock wilderness, perhaps dead or dying by a mountain pass after the Mongols had tortured him? Hammerschmidt admired Han Lu Chen's courage to mingle among such devils as these. Hammerschmidt had seen the bodies left behind at the gap. It was not a battlefield, but a slaughterhouse, he thought. Han was almost out of sight of the entrance, almost up to him.
Well?
Han didn't answer, clambered up over the high rocks in which Hammerschmidt had taken shelter, then dropped down into a crouch.
Michael Rourke is to be executed at dawn. He and the Russian officer will be taken out there into the open field before the main gates. Their wrists and ankles will be tied to Mongol saddles and General Wing, who commanded the army which captured them and killed all the others, will give the order for the Mongols to ride to the four winds. And Michael and the Russian officer will be torn limb from limb. A man can live for a short time after that, it is said. A very short time that would seem like an eternity. If nothing else, perhaps we could attempt to shoot them as a mercy to them. But the distance is too far for the guns we have. And there is something else. They have the missiles, or at least one. They have it as an object of worship.
An object of—
Yes, Hammerschmidt. That is the cult started by the Woman of the Dragon Robes. For years it has been rumored that Mao himself no longer rules, but that a woman controls his every thought, and that she had begun some strange religious cult. It is she who started using the Mongols as more than brigands. I do not know what to say. We must try, of course, must attempt to save their lives or kill them, but I cannot say how, Hammerschmidt.
Han Lu Chen bent his head into his hands.